Hi, Flourish.
This is our first ever podcast, and we're already cracking ourselves up.
Yeah, we're pretty funny to only ourselves. That's fine.
That's a good sign, though.
All right, so you are listening to the first episode of Fansplaining, the podcast by, for, and about fandom. And since it's our first episode, I think we should probably start with introductions. Flourish, do you want to go first?
Yeah, totally. I'm Flourish Klink. If you know me, you probably know me from Harry Potter fandom, where I helped run a series of conventions and an archive. And these days, I'm a partner in a company called Chaotic Good, and I basically explain fandom to Hollywood.
I'm Elizabeth Minkle, and if you know me in fandom, you only know me from the last 2 years, because prior to that, I was a total lurker. I was also in the Harry Potter fandom, but you'd never know it unless you met me IRL and I mentioned it. I'm a journalist. I have a column about fan culture for the New Statesman, and I talk about things that happen that tangentially or directly affect fans. So this is our first ever episode. Maybe we should talk about why we decided to do this. It was your idea, Flourish, so maybe you should talk about it.
So we were on a panel at Comic-Con together, San Diego Comic-Con. And it was a really big panel. There were a lot of great people on it, but none of us really got a chance to talk very much about what we were there to talk about. We each just sort of got a soundbite. So after the panel, we were talking in the hallway and I was like, dude, we should have a podcast and talk to each of the people who are on this panel and lots of other people.
Exactly. And the one thing that we were saying too is that we felt like we were having a lot of different conversations on this panel, but Flourish and I were having the same conversation. And so I think that's a good start for having these conversations coming from the same perspective, but talking to people from different perspectives.
I think that we're both pretty invested in communicating about fandom, but also not changing fandom, letting fandom be fandom. Hey, West Wing.
But also acknowledging that, like, lots of things are changing and have changed.
Right, because nothing's static, and we've both been around long enough. I mean, I think that I was reading my first fanfics in 96 or 97, so we've both been around long enough to see some real big changes.
Were you reading your first fanfic online in 96?
Yes.
That's really impressive. How were you, like?
I was
That's
10.
Impressive. Oh.
I was like 9, 10.
See, I was writing my first fanfic then, but I didn't, like, they didn't know there was an internet thing. I had legal pads. You would never guess what it was about. Literally never.
What was it about?
So you don't want to try to guess?
No, you just said I could never do it.
It was Sweet Valley High.
Sweet Valley High, man.
And you're from California, right? I would have been so, like, literally the most jealous person of you when I was 12.
I am from California, but by that point, I was already really over it. Like, I was mad at Dawn in the Babysitter's Club. I was like, she's nothing like me.
Yeah, I am shaking my head angrily right now, because how could you be over it? No, I moved to California after college, and I was like, it's nothing like Sweet. I moved to San Francisco. I was like, it's nothing like Sweet.
I grew up in Sacramento. There's nothing in Sacramento except politicians, tomatoes, and conservative people who get drunk river rafting on weekends.
That
Boom!
Literally like Sweet Valley High. That's it. The Wakefield twins right in there with the tomatoes and the rafting. Okay, so we're on this panel, and thankfully the panel was recorded, and you can go on YouTube, actually. My friend Sulagna accidentally recorded it on video, so shout out to Sulagna, thank you. But it wasn't complete video. You can watch most of the panel on YouTube, but the Geekiary website recorded the entire thing. And we might be putting the audio up in full if we have permission from them.
Yeah. So the Geekiary recorded our panel and may or may not be posting it in full, but they've been kind enough to let us use it today.
Specifically, Undy Girl. Thank you, Undy Girl.
Thanks, Undy Girl. I love your pseudonym.
Thank you so much for recording it. It's definitely a workable recording. We can hear all the audio. So, in kind of a fun game to ambush Flourish, I listened to it and pulled Jess. You should see the face she's making. pulled out some audio so we could talk about some of the clips, because brought up some of the issues that we thought came up on the panel and things we really wanted to discuss further.
Now, let's note, although I was on the panel and said some of these things, I haven't actually heard myself saying any of these things or anybody else saying any of these things since. So who knows what terrible things I said? Not me. Elizabeth knows.
No,
and she's covering her face with her hands. So anyway, we'll find out and we'll talk about it. And then I'll probably remember why we needed this podcast in order to explain the weird things we said.
Okay. So I think before we jump into these clips, we should very quickly explain who was on the panel and how the panel came about. And I know that you were responsible for putting it together to some extent, or advised?
In part. Heidi Tandy and I talked it through, and she's the one who actually was the formal putter together. She was the moderator. Heidi and I met when I was a preteen, and so we've been fan of friends ever since. And we often work together to put together panels for conferences, so we work together to brainstorm and figure out who should be on this one. And we had a lot of people. Probably too many, but in a good way.
Yeah, it's an interesting mix. So a few people were representing specific platforms that fandom spends a lot of time occupying. There was Aaron Levitz from Wattpad, Amanda Brennan from Tumblr.
Mm-hmm.
There was Meredith Levine, is how she says her name?
Levine. I say it Levine.
Sorry, Meredith. She's probably stewing the entire time when you said it wrong, but... Meredith Levine, who works for Zephyr, they work with YouTube?
Yeah. So Zephyr is a company that, as I understand it, helps YouTube figure out what content is infringing and not. And that sounds really evil, but it's actually a good thing because they figure out, like, what content isn't infringing.
Okay. And then I came as journalist. You came as a...
person.
If you met someone at a party, what would you say your job is? Like, if you had to say it in like a sentence, not like I do X, Y, and Z. If you had to say I'm a, do you have a word for that or no? Is it?
There's not really. You know, Meredith uses the term phanthropologist. Usually, when I'm at a party, I just stick with I work in film and TV development.
Gotcha.
We had Jules Wilkinson, who is the administrator of SuperWiki.
Supernatural Encyclopedia. Wiki.
Yeah.
Betsy Rosenblatt, who's a lawyer who works for the Organization for Transformative Works and spoke a bit about fair use. Okay, so we got everyone. And I guess, the original conceived idea was that, correct me if I'm wrong on this, by bringing people who work for the platforms where fandom is spending a lot of time these days and people who kind of analyze fandom on a broader level. Maybe analyze is the wrong word. That's only what I do. But, you know, look at fandom on a broader level and talking about how the platforms affect the way we communicate in fan or...
Well, yeah, in retrospect, actually, like, I think I was supposed to be talking about fandom as it was when... Like, I was supposed to be talking about older fan fiction archives. Betsy was supposed to be talking about the archive of our own. Jules was supposed to be talking about the wiki as a platform. So it was really supposed to be very much. I have no idea what you were supposed to be.
What was I supposed to be talking about?
I don't know.
I am a journalist, so I was analyzing.
There you go.
Right, I'm an analyst.
But yeah, so I think the original idea was that there are all these different types of platforms that fandom has been on, just like you said.
Yeah. Which is obviously an interesting question. Maybe we didn't really dive as deeply as we could into that, but...
Or almost at all.
But there was literally no time to dive. We could only all kind of, I don't know, swim in the shallow... There goes the analogy. So
doggy paddle, I think, is the term you were looking for. Doggy paddle.
Let's go to the clips.
Okay.
I guess I think from my perspective as a, as a books journalist, I remember, 5 years ago, I told a coworker, I worked for a fancy magazine that I probably shouldn't name, not to indict anyone. And I told her that I had spent the weekend writing fan fiction. It was tortured fan fiction, I didn't mention that part. And she said, don't say that word in this office, you know? And I was like, I'm so sorry. Like, I'm so embarrassed. And now when I talk about fan fiction with these people in publishing and magazines, they like want to buy me lunch. And I think that the big change in that realm comes from money, from people seeing particularly 50 Shades of Grey. And all these publishers go, oh, there must be more of that. But they don't really, I don't know if anyone here works in book publishing, but there's not really a full understanding. They can only see the end result. They can't see the organic growth. I think what a lot of this comes down to is money. And, I mean, you said that first, Elizabeth, but I think it's really true and I want to underline it. And actually, I'm really happy about that. So when I got involved in fanfiction at first, in fandom at first, it was this thing. It was totally hidden. It was secret. And I think that part of the reason it's not secret now is that, like, you can make a living doing it, and therefore you don't have to be ashamed of it. And I think that's sort of sick about our culture, that, like, you find it shameful to do something that, like, you can't make money from. But I think it's true. People would always say, like, why are you writing fanfic? Don't you ever want to, like, write original stories and make money with them someday? Like, well... But there's a lot of people who are coming from fandom, women especially, who are coming from fandom and going out and doing all sorts of different things, not necessarily being a YA writer or being a star from a YouTube, but also, like, explaining fandom to people, working in social media and PR. You know, even I would love to see more scriptwriters come out of fandom, because I think that that's a central skill that we hone when we write fanfic. And I think that opening up that, and I hope the next move is going to go from, like, here are some fans that we can, I don't want to say exploit, because I don't think that's really what I mean.
Collaborate on a terribly way.
Yeah. No, but I mean, like, an audience that we can figure out what they want better and, like, therefore make more money off of them because we're giving them what they want better, which I think is, like, that's a good thing. I actually sort of want to give people money for things I like, you know? That's cool. But I want it to go a step beyond that, and I hope that the next step is going to be a true appreciation for the talents that can be developed through fandom.
So, on the spot, initial reaction to you talking about how much you love money.
I do love money. Doesn't everybody love money? Let's just be honest with ourselves here. Everybody loves money.
Communists don't love money.
Okay. Communists don't love money.
Oh, I don't know. Priests? I don't, like...
Priests love money, dude. How many priests have you ever met?
It's true. They seem to like money. Yeah, I don't know. I read a lot of, like, wanky meta on Tumblr about how people in fandom don't want money.
Well, I think people in fandom don't always want... I mean, I want to... I think I came off suggesting that people in fandom should want money. And I don't think that's really true.
Well, don't you think that part of the problem with suggesting that... Actually, someone brought this up, and I don't believe I pulled the audio from this because it was a little fuzzy. But the final... It was one of the questions that we got at the end was a person saying... Why, what if you don't want to monetize this? What if you don't think of fandom as a skills building place? Like, oh, it's great that everyone on this stage is making money except for Jules.
Right.
Who was very explicit about how she didn't want to make money, but.
Yeah. That was something that I was definitely trying to get across and maybe didn't succeed at, which is that the reality is that in Western culture, money is really important. In the United States, it's a capitalist country. Money is like the yardstick by which things are judged. And skills and productivity are also something by which people are judged, right? When you like look online, like when you go online to minimalist bloggers who are all about getting out of consumerism, it's about losing your stuff so that you can be more productive. So you can be a better worker.
Yeah.
So I think what I'm fandom has become more acceptable because it has become more socially acceptable because of money.
That's so hard though, because I just feel like I personally don't see a huge, well, I mean, there could be exceptions. I'm not going to say carte blanche, every fanfic should become a novel. I think as a literary critic and a student of English, like I don't believe that many fanfiction stories structurally should be novels, or I think tons and tons of them, millions of them don't serve the same purpose as, you know, and that's fine. I mean, when I go around looking for like fake boyfriend stories, that's totally different than what I'm doing when I pick a novel up. That doesn't mean they're not amazing, you know?
Well, and that's the other piece of this, right? Is that I think that one of the way that fanfiction has become acceptable is because there's this idea that every fanfic should be a novel, or many fanfics could be a novel, or let's have Wattpad help connect your fanfic with somebody in Hollywood. And I don't think that that's actually, I agree with you. I mean, in my job, I do not option fanfics. Mm-hmm. That's not a thing that I do.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it will never happen, but it's, I do not read fanfic thinking, which of these people am I going to like pull out of the here and turn into 50 Shades of Grey next?
Right. Like, yeah. You're not some like weird fairy godmother, like trying to upend the,
Because most fanfic isn't that.
Right.
And doesn't want to be that and shouldn't be that. And that's not a value judgment.
Yeah. And I think even from the like the far high intellectual end of the spectrum, I'm friends with Ann Jameson, and I know, I think you are too, who wrote a book about fanfiction, when she talks about this a lot too, the fact that a lot of fanfic is network texts and the way they work together in a system. And, you know, it's not just about the story and plucking them out and, you know, turning it, because a lot of it doesn't work without that context. The system of tropes, the history, where these stories come from, how they link together.
So. Completely. And it can be, I usually don't like it when people compare fan fiction to Ulysses, because I think it's true in certain ways and really not true in others. But one way in which I think they are related is, man, you know, you read Finnegan's Wake, you get really pissed off at the thunder words because you don't know what they are. And that's the reaction that people who have never read much fan fiction before have to a lot of the tropes in fan fiction. There's like, they're like, what is this mpreg? That's like a thunder word. I don't get it. Like, not just don't get it in terms of what male pregnancy is, but more like don't get it in terms of what it means culturally within fandom.
Sure. You're upstaging me with a literary reference, so I can't connect you because I haven't read that.
Yeah, I mixed Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, so, you know, I look very non-erudite in that. Don't read Finnegan's Wake. You'll get to the thunder words and be like, what the fuck?
Oh, good sell. I am not going to, don't worry.
Good. Well, you were saying some interesting things in there that I don't think we fully addressed. You were talking about the fact that people can't see the organic way fandom grows. They only see the end result of, and again, the example was 50 Shades of Grey, but we might as well use.
I don't know. That's the one. I feel like a broken record sometimes because I talk about this organic thing a lot, because in the last couple of years since I started writing about, because I come from being I still am a book journalist and a book critic, but I also write about the publishing industry in general. And so I have started talking to people in the publishing industry, or even in a very casual way at BEA, Book Expo America earlier, you know, when you go to panels, and it's not people talking to me, it's when I go to panels and listen to people talking about it.
So you're going to, like,
be a journalist.
Conventions for publishers?
Yeah, Book Expo America is North America's largest, the commercial publishing industry's largest trade
trade
expo.
So you're at a panel on this, and
yeah, I've been to, so the last 2 years I've been to a bunch of panels that kind of relate to this, where they talk about, you know, the same thing, where they talk about the authors building platforms. And I think it's really hard because you see someone like the, you know, John Green or Rainbow Rowell, mm-hmm. people who look like it's like effortless, that's huge platforms, just like their books are flying off the shelves because, you know, because they built up such an audience who, you know, hangs on their every tweet. I'm sure there are other examples of people, authors who have a lot of tweets, but.
Well, I mean, what's funny is E.L. James is actually a good example of somebody who started aggressively marketing her story even when it was only fanfic. Mm. She used all of the tricks
right.
to make her story more read and more reviewed and get those numbers that would lead. And God bless her for it, you know? I mean, I think that that's a really valid thing to do, but
right.
it's not as though it wasn't work.
Right, yeah, absolutely. I guess the thing that I see where I see, it's impossible for you to look right now at an unknown author who maybe, you know, doesn't have that many followers and say, that's going to be the next hit. But it might be the person who is building something, who is very slowly building something that's going to become a fandom. And obviously, I know it's like an impossible task to say to publishers that, like, you need to look for people who mean it. You know, you can't just look for someone who has all the numbers there already. You need to look at the way that builds and the way enthusiasm builds. I think that's really hard for someone to just pop into. And I, you know, if you're not used to hanging out in these spaces and seeing that people talk about stuff and get excited.
Well, it's also more about, like, talent development than it is about talent exploitation. Mm. And I'm starting to sound a little bit movie industry right now, but that's okay, I think.
Yeah.
Right? I just came from VidCon where I was on a panel talking about developing shows. And when you think about things in terms of 50 Shades of Grey, like, let's buy it and repackage it and sell it, you're thinking in terms of let's make money on this one book, right? Whereas if you're somebody like an agent looking for a talent, you're looking at them and going, okay, you aren't there yet, but how are we going to nurture you so that you ultimately become really amazing? And I think that that's one of the things right now in the publishing world looking at fandom is they see it as a cash cow to some degree, or as a way to find like, oh, we didn't have to do anything. And right. These stories just rose to the top, right?
Yeah. Oh, and these billion readers will be a billion book buyers? Probably not. This is the thing that's also not proven, right? I mean, mm-hmm. 50 Shades of Grey is really the only one where you had huge read numbers that translated then to huge sales numbers. And it's not even that black and white. You know, a lot of the book sales came from people who would never knew it was fan fiction. We're going to be back with some more discussion in a moment, but first, we started this podcast in order to spark conversation. We want to hear from you, argue with you, air your ideas.
So if you have anything to say in response to what we're saying, put it online. We're Fansplaining on Tumblr and our Ask Box is on. Or tweet at Fansplaining. Or if you're feeling grandma today, leave a comment on our Facebook wall. Just search for Fansplaining and we'll come right up. Nitpicks, questions, suggestions for future guests. It's all fair game.
This might be a good time to mention that we've provided episode notes. They're posted on our Tumblr, tagged, well, episode notes. We've also got a transcript of the podcast available for anyone who needs it. And with that, back to the chatter. Okay, so the next clip. So I left little notes on all these clips for Flourish. And the next clip says, in which Meredith says things about selling info to hashtag brands that depresses me, even though I am a realistic person who exists in the world. Which I think about sums me up.
I mean, it's changed since I started with the company I work at. We do a lot of rights management, and major media companies were really hesitant to have that out there in bidding. And it's since changed with the concepts of our media, and I think social media has really changed fandom because it's really brought to the forefront of the minds of powers that be and brands with money that fans can actually show up in places and say, I count, and there's a way to count me. The way that I see it changing is suddenly now you can say, oh, well, this is exactly how many shit videos for Harry Potter there are on YouTube, and exactly how big X, Y, and Z community is to stand up and say, we're here, and it's not about breadth. You can measure depth and devotion is important, and now we're starting to see companies really understand what that means and trying to figure out how to make that work for them.
Meredith always sounds like she just came out of Planet Marketing because she's learned how to talk to them really well. But the thing that you have to remember is earned media just means companies have figured out that it's good when fans say nice things about them. That's literally all that that term means.
Right, you know? But like, can you blame your average fan for not loving that kind of language?
The way that the terminology, like the way that I can never blame anybody for not liking language that they don't use or that they don't find natural. But I actually kind of can blame the average fan for not liking the fact that someone would refer to fandom stuff as earned media, because before people in corporations used the term earned media, that was why we were getting cease and desist letters all the damn time in Harry Potter fandom.
Yeah, but... Mm-hmm.
Well, there's something interesting about the fact that the terms are so alienating. I do feel that as a fan, like when I go into my fan headspace instead of my corporate headspace.
Well, so here's a question for you. Earlier you were talking about what your company does and you used the term IPs multiple times. Mm-hmm. And I saw the other day A.O. Scott, the film critic for the Times. Is he still the film critic? I'm not sure. He's the big guy at the Times who writes about culture and angry articles about how we're all children. I don't know if you caught that controversy last year.
I caught that controversy.
That's good. He wrote his dispatch from Comic-Con, and he was saying something about how the San Diego lingo for, like, fandom was IPs.
Yeah, that's not a fandom thing.
I know. I was tweeting about it with some people, and someone said, well, that's how people in comics fandom talk about, say, Batman.
That's how like universe? Heidi and Betsy talk about it because they are lawyers.
Sure.
I find it a really useful term, which is why I use it even when I'm not talking to corporate people.
It's interesting because it just sounds cold and legal to me. And if I thought about Sherlock Holmes, I wouldn't think, oh, it's some intellectual property right there. I'd feel like, oh, he's an idea. He's a man. He's a, you know, like a legacy, a literary, it just sucks kind of the mystique about these big, broad, old universes that we kind of turn over and retell, which I find very interesting. I know people seem to be sort of weary of the fact that we are just recycling the same characters, but I think it's just more interpretations, which is exciting. But using legal language on it is kind of a bummer, but I also understand why it exists.
Yeah, so. I mean, it's a bummer, but on the other hand, you know, that I'm doing, like, you know, so I've been really into Hannibal, and whenever I'm watching Hannibal, whenever anybody's watching Hannibal, it's inescapable to think of the realities of that IP and who owns what copyright. Because the reason there's no Clarice Starling on Hannibal is because they're not allowed to have her. So she's been parceled out into the storylines over the course of, right? You're sitting there, you're going like, oh, now Will is more like Clarice. Oh, now Alana is more like Clarice, right? I mean, once it's been seen, it can't be unseen.
That's so hard. You know, like, I know people, like, do people want to see those parts, though? If you think about, I think that's one thing that fan works can expose in a way. If you just want to watch a show and enjoy it, and then all of a sudden.
Well, but different people like fan works for different reasons, right? Sure. Like, I've always liked fan works as critiques, and so my enjoyment of them is not diminished by my thinking about, like, why Clarice isn't on Hannibal.
This takes it out of the realm of pure artistry. You know, I used to write Torchwood fan fiction, so I know all about pure artistry. you know, but the fan fiction was really good. To be fair, it was much better than the show. No offense, Russell T. Davies. I love you.
But it is actually kind of interesting, right? Because when people in the literary world talk about fanfic,
rustle your fingers to gesture to the literary world?
The literary world.
I'm gonna be offended on behalf of. No, it's fine. Go for it.
No, but I mean, when people like in literature, when people talk about fandom, fanfic, they use terms like the death of the author, and it's really all about sort of separating out from like a romantic idea of having a story and getting lost in the story and all, you know. It's so funny because I feel like that's completely the opposite of a lot of fans' experiences, and yet that's what fandom represents to them because of the way that fans play with stories and rewrite them.
Sure. Or, you know, you talk about the anxiety of influence, right? These two influential critical theory papers that somehow affect the entire discourse about how people write fan works, but
I think that we're getting a little. I think the Thunder Words may be okay, but I think I probably shouldn't have gone all the way. The death of the author.
Death of the author. Too soon. Too soon.
Too soon.
Okay. Let's just do other clips.
One, and this is not disagreeing with you, but I feel that there starts to be a tier coming to the culture where the emphasis, even you're talking about non-commercial side of fandom, the skills you learn and what you do that you can then go on and, you know, a lot of us are in fandom not with that in mind. We don't want, all I want is to make friends and wank.
Oh, yeah.
There's a sense that some of that validation or legitimizing comes from, you know, either you can sell it, but even if you're not selling it, you're learning good things. And for me,
but I think that's why industry, I agree, but I think that industry has come to accept and be enthusiastic about it because of that learning good things thing. That may not be why fans are doing it. I hope it's not why the fans are doing it.
Yeah, and I suppose I'm just sitting here thinking, I don't care what industry thinks about what I do. It's really nice to run platforms for me to play on, but I suppose it's that. What place does this have in a fan conversation? So,
fair enough.
Yeah, and we might get some ideas from the audience later about that.
But I think you also, like, you do like that you can now have a, like, I like that you can now have, anyway, I like it, that you can now have a fandom, you can have a fanfic reading, right? I mean, and I think that that's the problem, is that I think that this has been part of why it's become, in the wider culture, more accepted. But unfortunately, those aren't the values. Like, I mean, certainly I didn't come into fandom thinking that I was like, this was going to be my career move, guys. And I still don't really like that. I don't, I have rules against working on things in fandoms that I actually like because I like them too much and I don't want to work in them, you know? Like, that's wrong, right? So I appreciate that. I just think that it's a tough, like, that's...
Okay, so literally... We're on Skype right now, and I was watching Flourish while her clip came on. And first, you looked like you were terrified of what you were gonna say something. Don't you think you'd remember? And then you looked down, and I swear it looked like you were on Final Jeopardy, and you were writing your answer down just now. That was incredible. I was like ready for you to hold up a sign and be like, "What is monetization of fanworks?" It's really
well. I do think that I said something there that didn't really get caught in the audio very well.
So what'd you say?
Jules had earlier been talking about how she enjoyed that now
tentacle,
she can hold...
Tentacle porn is what she enjoyed.
Oh, Jules loves tentacle porn. And when she comes on this podcast, I hope she'll tell us all about it. She literally brought a little
tentacle.
She brought
a tentacle. Stuck it right up there. Above the stage. You should see the visual. Why is this not a YouTube show?
Because editing video is way harder.
And we'd have to do our hair. Your hair's done. My hair. I have to do my hair.
But what I was saying is, you know, Jules really likes the fact that she can now hold fanfic readings in queer bookstores. And it's cool, which it would not have been 10 or 15 years ago. And so whether or not she likes that the conversation is all about fandom making people money or getting people skills, that's what she has to thank for it.
I mean, I think I can cop some of this too. I feel like I want to have my cake and eat it too, or maybe she does also. Like, we want to have this cake together.
That's, yeah, we shouldn't.
I
have the tentacles eat the cake.
I'm all annoyed that MTV was at Comic-Con and doing the fandom awards. There are actually a lot of the commercial networks being there and acting like it was, you know, super cool. But like, as I started out in my first clip, like, I shamed at work for mentioning I was writing fan fiction. And now if I said that, I mean, to be honest, I don't think that the people at the New Yorker, if I tell them about this or I tell them I was writing some fan fiction, I don't think people are going to be jumping for joy or asking to see it, but they might be more likely to say, "That's interesting," or, "Oh, that's something you do," and not, you know, not chastise me.
Right, and there are other people who lost their job over fanfic in the past who definitely wouldn't now.
Right. You one specific example, right?
So, right, I mean, Asia Romano once lost her job because she wrote fanfic. She wasn't like a preschool teacher who was like reading dirty fanfic to her preschool students or anything. It was just literally her boss did not like that she wrote Slash. That would never happen today.
Right. And now she is, in fact, employed to write about fandom. Like, she is a fandom reporter is her job. You know, and the fact that that exists, and even 3 or 4 years ago that didn't exist, I think is pretty extraordinary.
It's been a huge cultural shift.
But yeah, we can't have it both ways. There's an interesting clip. I'm not sure if I pulled it out of the panel, but someone said something about how there is a spotlight now and you can't get upset because it's you're going to get upset because it's shining on some things and you might say, "Oh, that's not what I know. Why isn't it shining on me?" But then, I don't want it to shine on me. You know, like, so you're going to be resentful that it's shining on other people and things you're not familiar with.
Right.
It's hard. And I always think that part of what it comes down to is that I feel like we get really hung up about who gets that spotlight because this is the stuff that we love. And we're like, you know, I think even some of the wank that comes from BNFs and people arguing about, you know, whose opinion is the loudest in the fandom is because you're like, "No, I love this the most."
Even when I felt most like, why won't they leave fandom alone? There was another level on which I was like, why won't they leave fandom alone? Except me, because I'm right. <You
know? laughs> Right. So I feel like this spotlight is dangerous because you also want to slip into it, even if you don't want it anywhere near you.
Right. It's one of those thoughts where you can hold two opposing ideas in your head at once.
Yeah, is there a word for that?
I think it was in 1984.
I didn't read that.
Oh my god, you're the one who has a literature degree. It could have been an Aldous Huxley.
I didn't read that either.
What were you reading?
Victorian literature. Yeah, you don't have time to read these important works of the 20th century when you're reading 900 pages about seating arrangements. That's... Regency literature, not Victorian literature.
I will say this. I recently read Vanity Fair and I enjoyed it.
Do they sit a lot in that? I bet they do.
Actually, they sit surprisingly little. They spend a lot of time in Napoleonic Wars, like in battles.
Like sitting on horses? They probably talk about that.
There are horses that get sat on.
All right, let's do the next clip.
I think it's really easy to get caught in this trap of monolithic fandom as a singular idea, that when I say fandom, I have an idea of what that means, but somebody else can have an idea of what that means, and it's very different from mine. And I think that within fandom, it's really, really diverse. And so you have all sorts of different cultures. For instance, like, some people migrate and move through, oh, I'm a fanfiction writer, I'm a fanfiction reader, I'm going to go on this, like, big bender and totally ignore the fact that I can read it all. And it's transient and it's diverse, but we say fandom, and I think really we mean fandoms.
Yeah, so fandom versus fandoms. I think one of the hardest things about this is that we all only get to see our own perspective on fandom.
Sure.
And there's a huge diversity of perspectives on fandom. I have no idea what's going through the mind of a One Directioner, even though I have friends who are One Directioner
people. Right.
Is that even the right term for them? I don't know. I'm an old, right?
Like, I have been to a One Direction concert, so I guess I can speak for them. it was wonderful. It was really great.
I believe it. Like, it actually seems like something I would really enjoy. But yeah, my point being, right, that they have a very different perspective about, like, for instance, what the most important archive is.
Sure.
And what the most important platforms are than I do.
Even, and like, just you and me, like, we have such different experience. We spent all of the 2000s in Harry Potter, but we had vastly different experiences. And I can say, remember that time when this thing happened from my creepy, lurky position, you know? And you'll be like, remember this and this and this? I'll be like, no. Like, and even like what you ship, or like what authors you read, or what meta you read, or if you do none of that, just the way you engage.
Well, and how you think about ships, right? So, I recently saw this really amazing Tumblr thing going around, and it was actually posted by someone I knew in Harry Potter fandom years ago. And it was people talking about Draco and Harry, and then someone was like, why would anybody ever think that Draco was straight? And then the response was, I think that he had a crush on Hermione. He's my bi angel. And the response was like, we found a Dramione. What do we do with them? And I was like, whoa, this is such a weird interaction on so many levels for me. First of all, because when I initially came into Harry Potter fandom, the argument was whether there should be any same-sex pairings in fan fiction because kids might read it. This was legitimately an argument that was happening. Second of all, because Dramione, what the fuck is that ship name? It's Draco Hermione. We don't smash shit together.
This drives
like
me
that.
Crazy. Can I just say?
But that's because we're olds,
I
right?
I can't get over it. Like, oh. You know,
anyway, my point being, though, that it was this moment where I realized that I was in a very different Harry Potter fandom than my old friends in Harry Potter fandom, who have clearly moved on with the times, whereas I am still, you know,
slashing,
creaking and talking about the
good old
days.
Those times were obviously much better. I'm literally sitting in the kitchen right now where I used to read Harry Draco in, like, 2001. I'm at my parents' house right now. I sat at the desktop in the middle of the night. So, hi guys, I hope you're listening to that, parents. it was G-rated stuff, though. It was completely
G-rated. Completely
G-rated. Pants,
all of it was
just wore the leather pants, G-rated. Held pants. So.
All of it.
You know, one thing that I think is important in when you're talking about different fan experiences and how there's not, I think, I can see it both ways. I think that both you and I, and we've discussed this before, use the term fandom when we say fandom is because we want to present to people outside of any fan experience.
Right.
I think you do need to present something.
And other people will do it for you if you don't do it, right?
Right.
I mean, this is – I often feel like I say things just because otherwise someone who is way, way less informed than I am will do it for
you. Yeah. No, you know what? Like, so I have this – you know, I read this column on fandom, and my first article was about a year ago. And it was just kind of explaining what I was going to do and saying, like, fans are more exposed and it's more positive in the mainstream for fans than ever. And the first two comments I got, I've committed them to memory because I'm so traumatized. They're, like, not that bad. Like, they weren't like, you should die in a fire. But one was, it's mindless consumerism. And the other one was, a fan is the lowest form of life.
A fan is the lowest like, form of life. This like, happened in 2014.
Like, bro, like, what is your problem? Like, really, you, like,
I mean, never read the like, comments, but still.
I know. And like, bless Caroline, my extraordinary editor. There's no more comments on these articles. They're not allowed. So that's a turn.
A victory of moderation.
She's the most sensible person in the world. You know, but like, and I saw that and I was like, oh no, maybe this was a mistake. Maybe the climate hasn't shifted enough if these are the first two responses, you know? And, but so like, I'm going to be over here like, fuck off. It's the fan. It's not the lowest form of life and it's not mindless consumerism. I'm not buying anything, you know, like.
Right. That's what's funny is that like I will be perfectly honest, like 90% of my job is explaining to people that fandom is not mindless consumerism.
Right. And, you know, I think it's hard for people to see they go to San Diego. I bought stuff. I don't know. That's a lot of my.
Everybody buys stuff. Me. That's what San Diego Comic Con is for. You can buy stuff at home, but it's less fun than when you buy it at San Diego Comic Con. Like, I'm not even a collector and I still buy stuff.
I almost bought a giant Harry Potter poster, even though there was literally no way I could take it on the plane.
But who wouldn't want a giant Harry Potter?
Yeah, and they were like, you could buy it online. I was like, it's not the same. And I was sensible. I didn't buy it.
I will tell you this, that my worst ever convention impulse buy was a Harry Potter marionette. It is 2.5 feet tall. It is creepy as fuck. And it's based on the German Harry Potter covers.
You are my hero.
It still lives in my closet.
What character is it?
It's
is
Harry. Harry.
Is it Harry?
He's okay. Holding a broomstick and he has Hedwig on his shoulder. Anyway, but the point is, right, that it's true. San Diego Comic Con is totally consumerist. But that's not all that fandom is. It's just that the only time that fandom wants...
Well, okay. I think we shouldn't be too narrow because that there's a large element of fandom that is material. It's about materiality. People who collect comic books. People who collect not comic books. People who collect action figures. And that's
not.
Consumerism feels like a shallow way to describe someone who values materiality.
Right. We don't necessarily, like, no one would call me consumerist for the thing you can't see here is that my home has literally every other wall, but the ones that are behind me right now is covered in books. And nobody calls that consumerist.
Right. Because that's seen as something of value, whereas tons of things that fans like is seen as, I don't know what. Childish,
yeah, because like, it's high.
You're wasting your money on these not adult. Look at the 40-year-old virgin where he's painting his action figures, and you're like, oh, you know, he throws them or sells them, and that's the way he becomes an adult man, and then he can have sex. I don't know. I actually like that movie, so maybe I should.
The 40-year-old virgin is good, but it does still have that moment where you have to throw your action figures away to have sex. And I am here to tell you that you can successfully have sex while still owning action figures.
She's waving an action figure. Right
I am waving an action figure right now. It's Scully.
Going back to the fandom versus fandoms thing, I think that Meredith has a really great point because there isn't one big fandom. The person who's defining fandom, it inherently gets to shape the narrative. And so I think that was one of the tensions on this panel, you know, between whether it was between the people on the panel or the audience and the people on the panel. You talk to people coming from these big corporate platforms.
Of course.
Even Betsy coming from the OTW or the AO3 in general, people who compile an encyclopedia are the people who determine, you know, the Wikipedia is written by men, right? And so it inherently
not super wiki.
Right? No, right, exactly, you know.
Yeah, but I see what you're saying is that we're in a situation where everybody has their own platform, and so nobody really wants to be spoken for by somebody, no matter how great that somebody might be, there's always something that you can disagree with and do disagree with.
But inherently, if you're, even if you're, do you mean people have platform like they have the right to say things, or you mean they're on like a platform, like a physical, like a social platform?
Well, I mean that people can post, you know, as opposed to, I think that people have, at least in theory, anybody can post a YouTube video and become really popular, right? Like, it's not true, but we all have this vision that if we just had the right, if we found the right way to say the right thing, we would all be really successful and we would be the face of fandom, or we would be the face of whatever, or just we would be famous, right?
Okay. So my boss has this expression, and he's a web designer and he's also a writer. His name is Paul Ford. I should probably say his name before I steal his line. And he said it's the rule, I believe he says the rule of web design, but I think it basically goes for anything on the internet as well, is why wasn't I consulted?
Yes, why wasn't I consulted?
And that's literally, that's exactly it. And you think that every time someone writes something about fandom, because it's like, oh, I'm an expert in this. Why didn't they ask me? You know,
right.
Like, yeah. And I think that's just, that's the inherent reaction. And I have to wonder if it's something about the web that really lends itself to that. Because when I watch TV and people are talking about something I know about, I mean, yeah, I probably actually get annoyed at them too. But, you know,
right.
But there's something about the democratized internet where I'm like, I could have said that louder.
So this next clip is a question from the audience, and we didn't get the questioner's name, so we're really sorry.
Yeah. And that's the problem with turning it super corporate. Or not like super corporate, but corporate at all. It's because fandom is a safe space, and it's a generational safe space, where like generations of fans can come together and like communicate with one another and like pass down like lore and mythology within the fandom itself, depending on how old the fandom is. And so like, and then you have like groups that like, yeah, I mean, it's so diverse, and like it's like LGBT and like race and so many different things, but like when it gets corporate, you lose a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what fandom this girl has been in, because I have never been in a fandom that was a safe space.
Well, can I say that having listened to the clip again, the one thing that I thought was interesting and kind of lended itself to what we were just talking about is she talks about how there's like lore that's passed from like older fan to younger fan, you know? And I think that kind of lends into our like how these narratives get created about what fandom is and what it's always been.
Right. And I do think that there's, I think that she, I mean, so I was unfairly dismissive just then, because I think that she did have a good point, which is, first of all, maybe she has been in a totally different fandom from mine, right?
Who knows?
Who knows?
She has been. She's a different person from you. You're two different humans.
I do think that there is something about that passing down, because there is something about that passing down, right? Like, the reason why, in early Harry Potter fandom, like, people would describe stuff as like RHR or HHR, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hermione, Harry, and Ron, Hermione. And
look, you don't need to spell it out for me. I got those.
I think
our listeners aren't going to
know
that. They're not going to know those pairings.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they're reading Dramione. Anyway, so the reason that stuff was spelled out like that was because of X-Files fandom, was because there were a few people, myself included, who had come from X-Files fandom, and in there people would write like SSK for Scully Skinner. And so, you know, the sort of shortening of the names came over. And so there is something about that lore, right?
Well, wait, why is it necessary from X-Files? I mean, before Harry Potter is reading Buffy, and that's the way they were shortened.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying that I know that it was, because when I got into Harry Potter fandom, there was only one fanfiction archive and there was no page on fanfiction.net. And so there were a limited number of people who were writing and reading and talking about it. And I know from personal experience that the people who were talking about it were
Got
coming
it
from X-Files fandom.
Sure, sure.
You know? Which,
right.
Take away my historian card. Personal correspondence with myself.
Right. But I guess I feel like, I don't know, it feels weird to call that lore, because it's like, no one guided me through anything when I was reading Harry Potter fanfiction, and I figured all this stuff out, you know? I mean, I guess maybe that's presuming that there's like some sort of ceremony where like an elder teaches you like the ways, whereas like you just kind of get it through osmosis. You're like, what is this? I don't get it. And then you're like, oh, I get it. I got
well,
it.
Well, in order to be part of the community too, right? I mean, like, so fanvitting is a great example, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more later, but for so many years, in order to like make fanvid, someone pretty much had to show you, because you were not going to think of hooking up two VCRs and VCR
sure.
editing shit to music otherwise. That was not a thought that was going to pass through your head unless someone showed you it. So yeah, I mean, I think that people do get lore, but you're right. I think people get it through osmosis, so it's hard to pin down. There is no like, you know, moment when you are inducted into the fandom.
Right. And even reading, you know, you can read a fandom's wiki that details the history of how things came about, or general fan wikis, or whatever, someone's narrative account of how things went down. And obviously, just like we were saying before, it's going to have the bias of the person writing those things or the community writing those things.
Completely.
If people talk about an event or an interpretation a certain way, and then it's like when you look at a photograph and then you remember the thing that happened differently, which is an actual, I listened to a TED talk on NPR about this, and that's actually what your memory, they said your purest memories are the things that you never think about right after they happened, and then you recall them 10 years later.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird to think about. Yeah, I listen to TED talks. Don't judge me. I keep talking about them. That's what I should be judged about. I'm like, I heard a TED talk.
I'm judging you for talking about TED talks right now. We can include that to sound conversational. You should include that to sound conversational. That's what our conversations actually sound like, is you saying things and me judging you for them.
I'm ashamed. I'm so ashamed. There's this fandom. We're not supposed to be ashamed.
We're not supposed to be ashamed. Therefore, embrace your TED Talk fandom.
Oh, God, no. I'm sorry.
Welp, that was episode 1 of Fansplaining, TED Talks and all.
So you know how we kept talking about having lots of perspectives on fandom, at least some of which are different from ours? That starts next week. We'll be talking to the other members of our panel. First up is Meredith, whose title is Fabulously Fanthropologist.
And if anybody wants to write us a Tale of Two Cities drabble, we promise to stage a dramatic reading.
Or just yell at us on social media about what you disagreed or agreed with. We're Fansplaining on Tumblr, Twitter, and Facebook. And remember, you can find episode notes and a transcript of this episode on our Tumblr. Special thanks to Sulagna, Undie Girl, Heidi, Erin, Meredith, Jules, Amanda, Betsy, and everyone who attended our panel at San Diego Comic-Con.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are not those of Stratus Media Ventures, Chimera Media Group, Chaotic Good, or our clients, or our employers, or anyone's except our own.